Hello, I'm Peter Howarth. I'm Global Clinical Scientific Lead at GSK, and it's my great pleasure today to welcome you to this non-promotional, non-CME disease state educational podcast brought to you by EAACI in collaboration with and paid for GlaxoSmithKline in relationship to the multi-specialty approach to the diagnosis of HES. Now, I'm really delighted to have with me today to discuss this topic Dr. Florence Rufos from the Hospital Erasme in Brussels, Belgium, and Dr. Maria Cid from the University of Barcelona in Spain. They will give us the benefit of their experience about the multidisciplinary approach to the diagnosis and management of patients with HES. And so perhaps I can start with Dr. Cid and ask you if you could describe for us your approach to the management of the patient of HES and the collaboration that takes place between different healthcare practitioners.
During the diagnostic phase, it is important to rule out other conditions. So usually in some internal medicine departments, there are the so-called quick diagnostic units where physicians are trained in diagnosis of systemic diseases. One of the first steps is excluding other causes of hypereosinophilia. And then depending on the context of the patients, if the patient has traveled to tropical countries or countries where there is certain diseases that may cause hypereosinophilia. So we have a referral, the tropical medicine department, that will rule out augmenting infection. Then an important collaboration, if the patient has skin lesions, are dermatologists that perform biopsies and can actually demonstrate a tisue infiltration by eosinophils. Then an important specialist are, of course, hematologists and hemopathologists to check for immunophenotype abnormalities in these patients or look for the genetic abnormalities underlying the myeloid type of hypereosinophilic syndrome. And it's important also sometimes the help of pulmonologists to identify the cause of the dyspnea these patients sometimes manifest and, you know, do LFTs, lung function tests to exclude typical asthma or chronic asthma. These are the main specialists. In occasionally when the patients have CNS involvement and have some strokes, so the neurologist would also have an important input in these patients.
No, thank you. And, you know, and it seems quite logical to us that, you know, we seek the best opinions for patients for the different manifestations of patients with HES. But I suppose, you know, from the other side, sometimes patients may wonder why a doctor isn't expert enough to deal with all these things themselves. And so, Dr. Rufos, how do you approach that with your patients about explaining the need for the multidisciplinary approach?
It's actually very rarely an issue because patients are generally very relieved to find someone who is going to accept to centralize information and management of their disease, of their rare disease. But they're also very, very happy to make sure that they don't have other complications, or if they have other complications, that they're going to be well managed for that in particular. So I think there's really two levels of management of these patients. For example, the patient in whom a heart involvement is suspected, you will send that patient to a cardiologist, preferably a cardiologist who has some degree of expertise in looking for the complications of hypereosinophilic syndrome and managing them as well. And it's also a form of guarantee that the patient will be getting the optimal, up-to-date standard of care for that heart involvement, which as a more general specialist, I might not be aware of the changes that are being made, for example, in terms of introduction of new molecules for managing heart failure. So it's pretty easy actually to explain that to the patient. He or she is very reassured that there's someone who's actually managing the patient as a whole, but also very reassured that each individual problem that he has that's related to the disease is going to be managed as best as possible by a specialist. And the specialist is also responsible for the follow-up of these complications over time. And it's important that it be the same team, in maybe even the same cardiologist, to really be able to say over time, are things stabilized? Are they getting better? Are they progressing, to be able to adapt therapy if necessary?
So just out of interest, do you all meet as a multidisciplinary team to discuss patients, or is it more a referral from one colleague to another colleague?
So it really depends. We used to meet. Then, obviously, with COVID, we stopped meeting. Yes. Yes. And it was replaced by a series of email exchanges, phone calls. The problem with meeting is that it's becoming increasingly difficult to reunite a series of subspecialties in the same time and place. And so I think that when that's not possible, obviously, if it's possible, it's ideal. It is not always possible. So when it's not possible, I think, once again, that's really the role of the centralizing expert who's in charge of the patient, is to have a kind of network of subspecialties and people working in these different clinical subspecialties with whom there are preferential interactions, to be able to very, very rapidly have responses to questions that are raised. So these multidisciplinary meetings, they can exist obviously physically. I think it's increasingly difficult for physicians to manage that, but they certainly continue to exist virtually.
Yes, no, the times we're in make it difficult for the face-to-face interactions. I entirely take that point on board. But certainly having a core group of specialists that you interact with and can become familiar to these rare conditions must be of benefit for the patients.
It is absolutely mandatory. It's a key feature of good care. Otherwise, a lot of time is wasted trying to find someone who's willing to handle a given complication.
So perhaps I can just ask there where the role is of non-clinical support, so laboratory support in the management and assessment of patients with hyper eosinophilia. Dr. Rufos, can you perhaps give us your insight from that perspective?
Yeah, so in addition to the clinicians, which are critical in assessing patients for disease manifestations, complications, and following them up and managing them, it's really important to have a well-run referral center, that a series of other people be involved in managing more the diagnostic and investigational aspects. For example, hematopathologists are really essential in reaching a diagnosis of myeloid-like hyper eosinophilic syndromes where the abnormal cytogenetics are not present. There are sometimes some very, very suggestive abnormalities on bone marrow samples that really suggest an underlying myeloproliferative disorder. Biologists, for example, in the laboratory for flow cytometry, it's very, very important that there be expertise in being able to tease out the abnormalities that one can see in T-cell phenotyping. Some of these abnormalities are common, maybe associated with aging, while others really have to be considered as potentially indicating the existence of lymphoid variant hyper eosinophilic syndrome. Cytogeneticists obviously are extremely important, and there are more and more tests that are being performed and new mutations that are being described regularly in association with myeloid disease variants. And even radiologists are very important as well, because some of the complications of hyper eosinophilia give some very, very specific imaging results. And so it's important that radiologists that are trained to looking at, for example, cardiac MRI, be able to recognize the features that are suggestive of subendocardial disease related to the excess presence of eosinophils in tissue.
No, thank you. I think that really gives us a good insight into both the clinical and the non-clinical infrastructure that's needed to be able to provide an all-round multidisciplinary best practice approach for patients with hyper eosinophilic syndrome, or presenting with hyper eosinophilia before you perhaps reach that diagnosis. So Dr. Sid, in your multidisciplinary practice, do you wait for things to manifest from patients and then seek advice, or are these patients sort of proactively monitored by different specialists just to make sure that they're assessing their function and situation.
So in these patients, usually we have among the whole specialists in our hospital, we usually have a specialist that we repeatedly interchange with that specialist that is somehow interested in providing advice in this particular patient. So probably we interact with a few people in each specialty, the ones that become more interested in this disease. Usually I coordinate the care of these patients, and then we seek for a specialist when we encounter particular signs of symptoms, but we do a multisystemic evaluation. And then maybe an exception of that would be a heart assessment, because sometimes can be problematic if you do not detect it in advance. Yeah.
Now, I think the point that you made, and also Dr. Rufos made, about the key role that someone takes overall responsibility for the patient and coordinates the different assessments, but has oversight, it is very important for these patients so they don't get lost. So perhaps I could ask you, Dr. Sid, if someone was thinking about setting up their own rare disease eosinophilic clinic where they might act as a referral center for patients with hypereosinophilic syndrome, what are the most common manifestations that you feel that they need to bring on board other disciplines to make sure that they are engaged in that initiative? Because obviously the manifestations can be many. Are there some key areas?
The skin is a key area, not only because diagnosis, that, but also because sometimes symptomatic treatments that dermatologists are more familiar with are really helpful for the patients. Then other manifestations sometimes that drive the multidisciplinary approach is heart manifestations, GI manifestations, and sometimes neurological manifestations as well, either from the peripheral nervous system or the CNS.
Thank you. And perhaps, Dr. Rufos, I can ask you, how common are gastroenterological manifestations in patients with hypereosinophilic syndrome?
So I think the answer to that question depends on the local geography and the way a hospital or a referral center is organized. These are not the most common manifestations of HES. And even if you look at organ-restricted forms of HES, GI manifestations are probably the least common, coming after isolated skin disease, isolated lung disease, and then I think that GI disease would come after that. Yeah. This was actually the case in a recent retrospective analysis of 100 medical files of patients that had been referred to, I think it's British Columbia or something like that. And it's completely coherent with my own activity. That being said, it exists. It's certainly
it exists. But other manifestations are more prominent, yes.
We definitely have gastroenterologists involved in our multidisciplinary referral center, because when patients do have GI manifestations, it's extremely important to have these specialists to be able to do endoscopy, eventually demonstrate eosinophilic infiltrates, although they will not always be present. It's sometimes very, very tricky to make a causal link between hypereosinophilia and GI tract disease, trickier than for the skin and for the lungs. So there may be other investigations that these colleagues can initiate that we are less familiar with.
Like food allergies sometimes.
Dr. Rufos, Dr. Sid, thank you very much indeed for giving us a helpful insight into the need for a multidisciplinary approach to the management of patients with HES and the need to consult with specialists where appropriate because of the protean manifestations that patients may have with HES, and giving us insight into what is best practice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.